And the motion picture is the most important art film ever devised by the human race. It is the art form that creates more empathy than any other. It creates our ability to step out of our own shoes.
I started as a salesman, Mr. Beale. I sold sewing equipment and automobile parts, hairbrushes, and electronic equipment. They say I can sell anything. I would like to try to sell something to you. You have meddled with the primal forces of podcasting, Mr. Beale, and you will atone. That's my favorite fucking scene in, like, movie history.
Everybody really missed out on the visual component of that performance, though, which I think is just a tragedy.
Look, I just did exactly the hand movements that Ned Beatty did.
Yeah.
So, watch the movie.
Did you know Ned Beatty shows up in this movie when there's, like, 30 minutes left? That's weird.
Yep.
He's not in it.
And we'll talk about it, but his arrival is so funny to me because he walks in with, like, three assistants behind him. Yeah. Two of which are women. He is shorter than all three of them. And you're just like, okay, who the fuck is this little dude?
Hey, he marches in.
He's got like
in.
A scrawny little mustache. He gets Peter Finch, who's been like this like god on the airwaves the whole movie. And he sits him down in a chair. And then he becomes a cosmic force that I think both killed God and the devil. And you're just like, what the fuck?
He brings a real sense of authority to his entrance. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Great Movies Pod, a podcast where we watch and talk about each of the movies covered in Roger Ebert's seminal film essay collection, The Great Movies. I'm Jana Gardner.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
And I will atone.
We're doing the bits.
Oh, it's going to be a good one today. We are talking about the 1976 film Network, a movie in which the character played by Peter Finch does not give an off-the-cuff speech 15 minutes in about being mad as hell and then kill himself on air, and the rest of the movie is about the fallout from that. That is not the plot of this movie. That's what I thought.
Is that what you thought the plot
of
this movie was?
Yes, that's what I thought the plot of this movie was. So I never had seen Network. One of those movies that...
So when they got to the Mao Zedong hour, like, what were you doing?
I realized by then that this movie had a different tone than I thought it did. I had thought that, like, you know, I'd never seen Network before. One of those movies, very big deal. Once you've gotten to a point where when you haven't seen it, it kind of feels like, well, now I got to wait for an occasion. Like, I'm not going to just, like, throw it on. And then eventually it was coming up in the book, and I was like, great, I'm going to watch it this weekend. But my whole life, I thought this movie was about Howard Beale gets, like, told he's losing ratings, he gets fired, he gives his mad as hell speech, he kills himself, and then the rest of the movie is, like, a drama, like very seriously exploring the role of the news media in society and, like, that sort of thing. So when, like, the bullshit speech happens at the beginning, I was like, did I miss the mad as hell part? Like, that...
And the bullshit is the second speech.
Yeah, that's the part where I was like, I thought that was going to be the mad as hell part, and then it wasn't.
Gotcha.
And then, like, once they decided to keep him on the air, I was like, oh, I see. And then I, like, looked up the Wikipedia page, and I was like, oh, black comedy satire, not searing drama exploring the role of television in society. So I learned a lot about Network.
I think this kind of goes along with what you're saying about the preconception of this movie, because I think people read it weird.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go to Letterboxd, and I think the most liked review comes from our favorite person, Brat Pitt, and just says, you think Aaron Sorkin ever jacked off to this? Okay, and if you think that, I don't think you understand what this movie is about. Aaron Sorkin loves his fundamentalist structures. He loves, like, you know, the programs that, like, benefit us in society. And this one's like, literally those don't exist anymore.
So that's kind of That seems like a review of the movie I thought this was, right? Like,
yeah, because people are stupid.
Because in
this is almost like the opposite of an Aaron Sorkin. Like, this is the opposite.
It's 100% of the opposite of Aaron Sorkin.
I would say, and I love Aaron Sorkin, but I would say, Aaron Sorkin, I do think, like, worships at the altar of Paddy Chayefsky. Like, and I think Aaron Sorkin probably watched this and thought, I can do that. It's just not what he does. Like,
it's like exactly. A totally different tone.
But I get the sense. Yeah, it's a totally different tone, but it is a lot of people in rooms talking about ideas. Like, that's the Sorkin-ness. But the tone, I watched like 30 minutes of A Few Good Men the other day because it was on TV, a movie I still love. But yeah, could not be more different. Like, could not be a more wildly different tone. I had no idea that this was such like a black comedy.
Yeah, like Newsroom, one of my big gripes with that show is that like basically everyone's good in their own way.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is like everyone's bad. An evil piece of shit in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think if Paddy Chayefsky saw the scene where they announce Osama bin Laden's killing on a plane, he would have like murdered
that
Aaron Sorkin and every actor.
One
in that
of scene. The funniest scenes ever put on television, unintentionally so, but. But yeah, so I think like I said, the tone of this movie is just wildly, wildly different than I was expecting, which was fun. I may think it's a bit much. I'm not sure, like, by the end, I just was kind of like, okay, like,
the end, I think, kind of falls apart for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, we'll talk about
Ebert it. Ebert has a good quote where he's like, and by the end, where they decide, like, what to do with Howard Beale, like, you're in as much of the madness as you could be, and it's crept on you. And it's like, no, it still kind of feels kind of crazy to kill
exactly.
someone.
Exactly. I think we're way jumping
the final
at least like that.
The final line of the movie is so funny.
It is very funny.
It's hilarious.
I'm sorry. It's
no,
really
it's
good.
Very funny. And the ending is just played so straight that, like, it's a wild move. And I think I'm kind of with you, Dylan, where I was like, okay, I know this is like a satire, but like, this should be a little bit more winking than it is, like this final conversation. But it's ballsy and it works.
Yeah, it's fun.
So, anyway, let me back up. As I just said, I had not seen this movie until this weekend, but what about you, Dylan? When did you first see this?
I've only seen this like a long, long time ago. And I always felt like it was a little overdone and a little, two-dimensional or at least three-dimensional. And people thought it was four-dimensional. I liked it a lot more this time, but some of the problems still stand with me, and that is mainly the ending. And this is like probably heresy to say this, but Peter Finch.
You don't think he's good?
Interesting.
I think he's solid. I think he's very good. I don't like his storyline. And I think the movie, and this is what I didn't understand, but the movie feels like his storyline is pretty stupid as well. Well, like, at least the Ned Beatty reaction is what I thought the whole time. Like, it's just so empty and full of hot gas. And I don't think I realized that on first watch, but it didn't completely leave me that, like, I don't have a lot of weight in Peter Finch, and he's probably my 7th favorite performance in the movie, looking at the cast list.
I think his performance is really great, but I think, like, Howard Beale isn't really a character in the movie.
I think your anchor is supposed to be Max.
Oh, 100%.
William Holden. And William Holden kind of got robbed from this Oscar, in my opinion, by Peter Finch, because
Bobby D got robbed.
I was going to say, I was like, my dude Bobby D, really.
He didn't even get nominated, and
Bobby D got nominated.
He did?
I'm talking about Robert De Niro, not Bobby
Duvall. I was talking about Bobby Duvall.
different Bobby D.
Well, when we're in this era with Robert De Niro and Robert Duvall getting nominated every year, like, we need to specify which Bobby
D driver?
This is the Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Here. Yeah.
To be fair,
oh, we're gonna have a lot of Oscar.
I still can't speak.
Taxi Driver has Robert De Niro, and Taxi Driver has to win this Oscar. Like, in all honesty, but between the two of those, like, William Holden kind of knocks Peter Finch out of the.
He's for sure supporting though.
Had De Niro just won for Godfather 2? That probably was part of why De Niro.
Yes.
He won two awards ago. Yeah,
before.
So, you know.
But you know who else won like 2 years before winning a second? It was Mahershala Ali. Okay. Like,
well, I mean, Green Book was just such an undeniable movie.
Yeah, like you can't.
They had.
Yeah, Green Book's more iconic than The Godfather Part Two and Taxi Driver.
So that was.
Well, you know what's funny is, I mean, let me just say this out front before I get into this part, because Rocky is a much better movie than Green Book, but Rocky sweeps so many awards that it's just not held up in like popular critical conscience that it's funny. It's not embarrassing like maybe Green Book will be, but it's like Rocky beats All the President's Men, Bound for Glory, Network, and Taxi Driver. John G. Avildsen, who beats Alan Pakula, Ingmar Bergman, Sidney Lumet, and Lena Wertmüller. What? Like,
it's
well, and what's funny honestly. Is
like Rocky's. I think Rocky's fine, but like, what are we doing?
Rocky's a very fun movie. I like Rocky a lot. But
great that Paddy Chayefsky won the original screenplay Oscar for this, and that Rocky didn't win that one. But that is funny that that's the one Rocky didn't win, because I feel like that's the narrative is like Sylvester Stallone wrote this script. Like when you think about Rocky, you're like Sylvester Stallone. Yeah, he wrote that. It's like, did he get the? No, that's the one Oscar it didn't actually win. Was for the screenplay, which is good because that would be insane. But like you said, for director, that's crazy. Over that list. Wild stuff. Before we get to Oscars, Nick, Nick, when did you first see this?
Sorry, Nick.
It's been a long time. I remember for Christmas one year, my folks got me, it was a box set of like media related movies. So it was two Lumets. It was this and Dog Day Afternoon. And then All the President's Men was the third one.
Another nominee this year.
Yeah. And I think that I found, like, I've always liked Network, but I think it was sort of the weakest of the three.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not rewatched Dog Day in a very long time, but I've seen All the President's Men within the last handful of years. And I think that's still probably the case.
Yeah.
Like, All the President's Men is just incredible. And this is, like, I think very good, but maybe not incredible.
Yeah.
But yes, we can move on to, sorry, I was looking at the Oscar list. We can move on to Oscar chat, because this is a...
So I have a quick wild Oscar game I want to play with you guys.
Okay.
All right.
So...
Should I close
I was going to say, should we not be staring at the awards list?
Yeah. Just...
Okay.
So I don't think you guys had this up, but we're going to do two games. One is... Network was the second movie in history to be nominated in all four acting categories. Actor, actress, supporting actor, supporting actress. So it got nominated Peter Finch for Best Actor and William Holden. Actress, Faye Dunaway. Supporting actor, Ned Beatty, who's the only not winner of this movie, which, fuck you. And Beatrice Straight for supporting actress. Okay. What was the other movie to have this thing happen? It won three like this movie did, but was nominated for all four.
Was it all
about
Eve?
That's what I was going to say.
Good guess, but no.
That was my exact.
I think it didn't have a.
It didn't have a best actor.
It didn't have lead actor. Yeah. It had actor, yeah, couple no supporting, actor and supporting actor. Yeah.
Every time you guess, I'm going to give you guys a clue. Okay. It's from the 50s.
Okay.
The 1950s.
1950s. Not the 2050s.
Or the 1850s. Okay. It's a movie we've covered on the podcast?
It's not a movie we've covered, but I believe it comes up in his later books, maybe in book three or something.
Okay.
It was nominated for Best Picture.
I figured. That'd be weird if it was nominated in every acting category.
Well, I was going to ask... I was going to maybe quiz you guys on this, but I'm not sure if you get it. There was one movie to be... nominated
happened?
In all four adding categories and not get nominated for Best Picture.
That's happened?
It's My Man Godfrey.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have.
Oh, weird.
Would not have.
Yeah, I don't think you guys would have been able to guess that one, but.
Yeah.
So this movie was nominated on a four, won three.
Okay. Did it win Best Picture? Oh, no. So did it win Best Picture also or no?
I will give you that information if you guys guess another movie.
A movie from the 1950s.
Can't think of it. My mind's going blank.
I know. I'm literally trying to think of...
What's a movie from the 1950s?
Exactly.
You guys can just pull open Letterboxd and start scrolling through movies of the 1950s.
That is true.
As long as you don't start like looking at like who got nominated in those Oscars. But like... I don't mind if you guys have a list of movies to guess through.
Tokyo Story. Shit.
Should have.
Throne of Blood.
Oh my God, Nick. I need a serious guess.
Okay, hold on. Give me 1 second to remember what
movie. It's a Hollywood movie.
Oh, so it's not A Man Escaped.
Okay. I would like to know the supporting actress and actress.
Hold on. Something I said just set off my alarm. And hold on. Hey,
wait,
hey
what?
Google, stop.
What is going on?
Something I said triggered our little Google Home bot to start like blaring an alarm. So I had to stop it. Singing in the Rain.
Good guess. I don't know how many Singing in the Rain. It did not. It was not Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
It was,
I don't think Donald O'Connor.
Rude.
Mm.
Is it Giant?
It's not Giant. That's a very good guess. You have like four.
Is it a Jimmy Dean?
It's not a Jimmy Dean. I will give you, let's see, what would be the better hint right now?
Hold on. Singing in the Rain only got fucking one acting nomination.
Are you fucking serious?
Gene Hagen. That was
I love Gene Hagen, but that's it?
That's fucking insane.
Wow.
What are they doing?
That is just wow.
That's terrible. That is all right. I don't know. 1950s.
Wait, so did the movie win Best Picture or no?
It did not win Best Picture, I'm sorry. Okay.
And like start now all I want to do is start guessing movies that like I know it, like I'm, that I'm seeing came out in the 50s that I know it can't be and being like or debt. I know.
Is it a Ford?
It's not a Ford. I will give you the director. I'll give you the director. It'll kind of
it can't be 12 Angry Men. There's no women in that.
No. Yeah. You know what, I'll tell you the the supporting actor winners were Carl Madden and Kim Hunter.
Is it it?
Oh, is it On the Waterfront?
No, same director.
Oh, so I haven't seen that many Kazan movies. Is it East of Eden?
Nope, not a Dean.
Oh, not
that's
a Dean.
Right, yeah, you said not a Dean.
Marlon Brando lost Best Actor for this movie. He was the only person not to win. And Vivian Leigh was the Best Actress winner.
That's not Street. No, that's not Streetcar.
It is Streetcar.
Oh, Streetcar Named Desire. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, all right. I've seen that. That's one I've seen.
There you go. I've never seen it.
Yeah, so Marlon Brando was the only actor not to win from that movie.
I forgot that Carl Malden was in that. Does he play the husband of... Or wait, no. She's divorced. Isn't she? Blanche. Not to spoil.
So it lost to An American in Paris...
Ha.
Which was a George Stevens movie, and who did Giant, so that's a interesting crossover there. But Marlon Brando lost Best Actor to Humphrey Bogart in The African Queen.
Mm.
Now, there's been a few other movies that have gotten all four acting Oscar nominees, but didn't win three of them. Three of them is the most. When you, so a fair bit of one, two, or one. The only movie, My Man Godfrey was one of the two movies to not win any of the four. The last one to get nominated in all four was the other movie not to win all four. Do you guys know that movie?
The last movie? Like the most recent?
Was
it American Hustle?
Yeah.
Damn, yeah.
Because that movie went 0 for 10. Not only was it... Did they not win any of the acting nominations, but it was nominated for 10 Oscars and won 0.
Ironically, the time before that as well was Silver Linings Playbook.
Right, but that won two of them. Silver Linings.
Lawrence was the only winner.
Sorry. I was you said
Cooper, De Niro, and Weaver all lost.
You said Silver Linings Playbook, and in my head I was picturing The Fighter. Which
Fighter didn't get all four.
No, but it got two wins.
But it got, yeah.
It got Bale
the two and... supporting actor wins.
Yeah.
Carl Malden plays like Stanley's friend who is into Blanche.
Oh, okay. Actually, it was quite a gap between 2012 and 1981 when it happened the time before that, which was Reds. Have you guys seen Reds?
I have not.
No. I've seen Red.
A little with, different.
With Bruce Willis and...
Yeah. And isn't Helen Mirren?
And Helen Mirren.
Helen Mirren, Morgan Freeman.
Malkovich, I think.
Malkovich is the fourth. Which is hilarious because Malkovich is like 30 years younger than the other three.
Those movies always have that. There's always like in those like we're all old. It's like in Space Cowboys. I can't remember who it is, but one of the four guys in Space Cowboys is like fully 25 years younger than everybody else. It's like it's really funny.
Is it Tommy Lee Jones?
I think Tommy Lee Jones is like 50.
It's just because he's always looked about 60 years old.
Yeah. I was thinking to
be fair, he hasn't aged past 60 since he's gotten past 60 either, so...
I was going to say to get us
working out for him.
I was going to say to get us back on track, but it won't because then I have another digression. I was thinking today about how it's weird that like I don't know what Robert Duvall looked like as a young man. Like the youngest I can picture him on screen is in To Kill a Mockingbird, and he's 30, and he's on screen for 2 minutes, and then in The Godfather he's 40, and so like, and he's always had that hair. The youngest he looks is in Apocalypse Now because he gets to wear the hat. And if you can't see his hair, he looks like 15 years younger. But it's just funny that like, I feel like dude has been old my literal entire life.
He's 91.
I was just about to say.
Him and Faye Dunaway are both still alive. Yeah, he's 91. She's actually not that old. She's like 80.
Well, yeah, because the age difference between her and William Holden, that is like... 30 years?
Plot point, at least. sorry, I was going to say, but last back to the Oscar digression, doesn't seem like there's any movie this year that could get four nominations, like all four acting Oscar nominations.
What could be the closest? Honestly, Everything Everywhere All at Once.
That's...
If they campaigned...
James Hong is supporting... Kwan.
If they campaign Kwan in a lead actor,
which
I don't think they're going to do.
No.
But no way. That really could be a...
I guarantee you that the Oscars will never have four Asian people nominated at once. Like, they would never fucking do it.
Yeah, fair. because I mean, you look at, like, stuff...
Do you know how badly it pained them to give Best Picture to Parasite, like, as a group?
Do you remember when no Parasite actors got an acting nomination?
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That was so bad.
That's what I'm saying. Like, these people are just, like, they could not hate Asian people more.
I'm assuming you guys want Michelle Yeoh to get nominated, despite your reservations about the movie.
Just get her nominated every year. And I want to keep...
That's true. You're like, I don't even care. It's just not... I'm just looking, like, all the stuff that's the acting frontrunners so far are these, like, really, you know, something like, you know, Tar. Oh, God. I talked about The Whale. Or like women talking, like just a lot of stuff that's very, or like Banshees of Inisherin and stuff. It's like a lot of men, a lot of women. I'm not seeing a lot that's like a well-rounded everybody in lead and supporting kind of.
And I feel like that's kind of happened over the years where it's either like a men movie or a women movie.
Yeah. Where, yeah, you either have, you might have a bunch of women in lead and supporting and then like one man.
One man in a supporting role.
Yeah, or then the or other vice way versa. Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of.
We don't have good male-female dual lead movies anymore.
David O. Russell. He's our guy. The problem is he makes such shitty movies.
Yeah, and this Amsterdam is not even getting, like, you know, his last few movies, like, sort of were generally well-received, and then there was some dissent or backlash. This is, I've seen, like, maybe one or two people who were like, Amsterdam's okay. And, like, that's the best that anyone can ride for it.
What's so sad is Amsterdam sounds like the most me movie
ever. It does.
Ever.
It sounds like
just
the
like
most
a
fun.
Wonderful screwball comedy, like
the
societal.
Fun. The, like I'll watch it at
seems
home.
Seems okay,
I don't know.
But this is the thing: is all the David O. Russell trailers look fine, and then I see the movie, and I just feel like I'm getting banged over the head with a wooden mallet.
Yeah.
The movie that actually could, the movie that actually could get all four is Babylon.
Oh,
if that lead actor, if that, yeah. if that, I don't know who the actor is because it's like his first movie.
Yeah, the
or
like Mexican American actor, I believe.
He might have been in Mexican movies before this. Yeah, I just don't know. But this is his like break into Hollywood. If he did well enough, he could get actor. Margot Robbie could be actress, and then there's quite enough supporting
cast,
characters
yeah.
there that you could.
I mean, yeah, yeah. Oh God, I forgot Babylon's coming. That's exciting for me.
Fun trailer.
I was making a spreadsheet this morning of like the releases for the rest of the year, and it was genuinely stressing me out.
Jean Smart from Babylon is currently eighth on Gold Derby.
Yeah. Based on 30 seconds, not even based on 3 seconds that she's visible in the trailer. That's pretty funny.
I just watched a movie with Jean Smart in it. It's called
People Just Go
Sweet
Wild
Home.
They do it these days. Oh, right. Yeah, we'll talk about
Sweet Home
Alabama.
That was before
Alabama
she
later.
Was like the Jean Smart of now.
The only thing that lives on in my cultural consciousness from Sweet Home Alabama is anytime anyone brings a baby to a bar, a thing that happens more often than you'd think before your friends start having kids, and then you can say you brought a baby to a bar, and that's the best. That is how Sweet Home Alabama lives on, and pretty much the
when
only
when Melanie Lynskey showed
it.
Up, I was like.
And that's the thing that like is even so great now is remembering that's Melanie Lynskey and just being like, oh, that's nice. That's very fun.
Also, every parent in that movie is just like God tier actors.
Oh,
because like
it's Candice Bergen
and Fred Ward
yeah.
and God.
Yeah, that
good cast.
I can't believe you watched.
Remember when we casted rom coms like that? Yeah. Like, I also just saw You've Got Mail this past week, but
you're
just
catching
like,
up on '90s turn of the century.
Oh, I've seen You've Got Mail. Okay. I showed Kasia You've Got Mail. She showed me Sweet Home Alabama. Yeah,
neither of those are my favorite. I appreciate them for
I was
what
say,
they
you,
are.
You guys should
watch some good ones.
Show each other some
That's
good
what I was going to say.
I love You've Got Mail, and Sweet Home Alabama was fun.
Yeah, they're totally fine. They're just not like, but they're absolutely the kinds of movies that it's like I can say those aren't my favorite rom-coms and still wish they made those movies. You know, like I still want them to exist. I just. Yeah, because like you said, rom-coms now are like straight to Netflix and they're so cheap. Like those movies are expensive. Sweet Home Alabama and You've Got Mail. It's just like stars and locations and, you know.
They all look like shit now.
Everything looks like shit now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so Network.
I was going to say, that's a good way to lead us back to Network.
Speaking of movies that look like shit.
So this was shot, by the way, by, I made a note of his name and now I lost it.
It's Owen Roizman.
Thank you. Who
is just the goat of Sundance cinema.
Yes. And
he was like mainly
this
Friedkin's
movie looks
guy.
Fucking great.
Yeah.
It looks so good.
Yeah. Yeah. He also shot The French Connection. He shot Liza with a Z, which I knew and forgot. But The Exorcist, Pelham 123, like just wild, wild filmography for
three days.
Con.
Like, yeah, some
Boom,
like big '70s heavy hitters.
Mm-hmm.
3 Days of the Condor, Heartbreak Kid, like some good shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Addams Family.
Oh, I forgot he did his '90s. He did the Addams Family and Grand, and then he closed out his career with a trilogy of Lawrence Kasdan movies: Grand Canyon, Wyatt Earp, and French Kiss. Which Wyatt Earp actually
is Addams Family the best Barry Sonnenfeld movie?
No,
I think it might be for me.
Hold on,
is it Men in Black?
It's Men in Black. 100% for me. Addams Family also good. Get Shorty, also good. But Men in Black is my favorite. Barry Sonnenfeld. What if I said it was What if I said it was Wild Wild West?
Wild Wild West.
I was about to say, what do you think of RV?
I skipped that one.
so did most people.
Yeah. Yeah, Barry Sonnenfeld is a director that Blank Check has sort of talked about doing for a long time. Just because this is a wild run. of movies, from Adam's Family to Nine Lives.
Which I have seen and did kind of enjoy.
Oof. That's Kevin Spacey's a cat?
Yes. Okay. Watching it back now would be really uncomfortable.
Sometimes do you think the better or more important the movie we're covering is, the less we talk about it?
Yeah, yeah, I'm so sorry, Network.
Yeah, I
feel like on Body Heat, we were like on fucking top of it, just talking about
Body Heat. Body Heat also rules, but it's kind of
Body Heat does
more
rule.
You know what? No one throws a chair through a window in this movie.
Yeah,
so that's
there's
really
more bits we can like kind of dig into on Body Heat.
Network for a
it's
for
fucking
what,
clean
for what turned out to be like way more of a comedy than I realized. Not a lot of bits we can latch onto. Also, all of the like.
Hey, remember when they have the guy killed
yes,
on TV?
Yes, yeah. Hilarious. I was going to say,
this was a story.
All the things about this movie have, like, you know, I mean, we can't do, like, a bunch of, like, I'm mad as hell jokes. Like, that was old hack, like, 30 years ago. So, 40
That was
years
old
ago.
Hack during the movie. That's the point of it. Yeah. Like, it's like, this is, like, the most empty, like.
By the time the audience is just, like, rotely reciting it at the in the taping. Yeah.
And I love that Ned Beatty's like, just go shout about like America and democracy and a bunch of stuff that doesn't really exist and just like, go have fun. It doesn't matter.
And then it gets too depressing for everybody.
Stay away from the money. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that makes Network, I feel like, kind of impossible to talk about, because you're watching it and you're, you know, and there's literally lines where someone's like, you know, all people are talking about is, you know, inflation and the Russians and crime in the street, and you're like, oh, get it, it's like now, it's like today, except for it's then.
It is very like,
but like,
and let's move our news programming and call it opinion programming, and then we can do whatever we want, which is like the entire Fox News ethos. And it's like, it's not new or interesting to be like, yeah, this movie both predicted everything that was going to happen in television news broadcasting, and also nothing has changed in 50 years. Like,
cool. And you could say that in every year. Like,
right, exactly. That's kind of it.
That would be what was
it's
on the
eternal.
News.
Yeah. And so it is just kind of, you can't be insightful being like, this movie has a lot to say about the way we live now, which it does, but like, obviously, you know?
I mean, its whole point is it's trying to be so intensely insightful.
Right.
And I think that's why I kind of like something that's like another movie, and I kind of forced you guys to watch this on the podcast, but Real Life, which is just sort of a movie that almost accidentally lucks into something that would be incredibly insightful every year that passed.
So I was thinking about Real Life, I guess, because it has a lot in common with this movie. And then also I just saw it referenced somewhere that I was reading this weekend as well.
People are referencing Real Life?
Someone's referencing Real Life. But because I was thinking about how I did enjoy Network. I really liked it. You know, shocking opinion. But like, black comedies are just the toughest genre to pull off. And one of the reasons I struggled with Real Life, like objectively like a really good movie, is it was just like on the razor's edge of being like too unpleasant for me to like sit with, which I know is the point, and that's like what Albert Brooks is going for in that movie. But that's the kind of black comedy that just teetered over into, oh, I don't enjoy it. This is really unpleasant. I don't like what's happening to this family. Like, and also in that movie, it's like happening to a family. Like you said, in Network, it's just everyone's terrible. Like, you don't really have to feel bad.
Beatrice, when we talk about the newsroom, is kind of boring, where it's like everyone's just too good.
Yeah.
I think the lack of any humanity in Network is maybe its weakest point as a movie to connect with. But
I wouldn't say
is
that
it wrong?
Because I think the Max character is pretty sympathetic, even though he does things that are stupid. He's at least
he's the closest to humanity we get.
The most human character is, I think, is Beatrice Strait, is his wife. But what's funny is that like the most sort of heart-wrenching human moment is still played so huge, like her famous moment, you know, her big speech. Like,
I was gonna say Beatrice Strait was my other least favorite performance.
She's too big for me.
Matt walked in, he was like, what is this actress? Is she like from the 40s? What is this? And I was like,
I was just re-listening to the Godfather rewatchables where they talk about like Talia Shire, like throwing plates at, and like, that was like a similar sort of vibe of
so
like
my defense of that performance and that scene that I was mounting for Matt this morning when he like literally came in from the other room when I was watching the movie and he was like, what is she doing? I was like, I think it's on purpose. I think she was probably directed that way because this movie is kind of a satire. So and I don't know if this is true or not, but I have to imagine she was told to go big, like, especially because that storyline is so meta. Like, he literally is like, oh, yep, this is the textbook
talking
thing.
About. This is the part of the script.
And then
don't worry, it'll go badly. And in the end, I'll come back. And then, like, then that conversation repeats at the end when him and Fade and Away are breaking up, and he was like, yep, and this is where, you know, and she's like, and this is where it goes sour. And I don't know, I didn't hate that, I think the second
version of that speech works so much better, like maybe not even as it is written, but just his performance of it when he's talking to Fade Dunaway is, I think that's a really good scene.
I like that scene, the more human scene.
I wish that the scene with Beatrice Straight could have been like that.
And that's also like, it's Faye Dunaway's like one chance at like showing some vulnerability. Like, she tries, she just doesn't have any goodness in her to like go along with.
That's why Faye Dunaway, I think, is like the performance of the movie.
Yeah.
At least of all the main characters. So.
But it is, to go back to Oscar talk, it is wild that Beatrice Straight won the Oscar for this. Yeah. I mean,
I think if she gives a quieter performance, like one that we maybe would have liked more, she's not getting attention. She's only in it for five minutes.
She's the reference all the time whenever like any performer is there getting Oscar buzz or gets an Oscar nomination for some tiny performance. It's always like, oh, it's a Beatrice Straight.
William Hurt in History of Violence.
It's all, the reference is always, oh, it's a Beatrice Straight performance. You know, they come in five minutes, they scream or they just take over the scene or whatever. So
I remember hearing that about the Viola Davis and
Doubt performance. I was thinking the same thing.
That's where I started learning about like network, and it's like, oh, it's a Beatrice Straight. And it's like, so, I don't know what that means.
So I can't.
It's like she's in it for 5 minutes. She's crying until like snot drips out of her nose. It's pretty like unforgettable whether or not it's like too over the top. I think that one works better than the Beatrice. I don't hate the Beatrice. I don't hate Beatrice Straight either.
Like,
I would not have.
It's a fine moment. I just don't know.
In no fucking way am I giving her the Oscar over Jodie Foster.
I know.
or you want to talk about a great over the top?
Piper Laurie.
Piper Laurie and Carrie. Yes.
I always forget.
She's out of control in that movie. Oh my god.
In the perfect way. I just rewatched Carrie. I can't remember earlier this. I rewatch Carrie all the time. But I rewatched it a few months ago. And man, that ending in particular, like, oh, God. She rules in that. And it's the exact perfect, like, perfect vibe, perfect.
Yeah. She's like over the top in a way that like fits so well with the movie. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is what we were sort of talking about with why the Faye Dunaway scene works so well, is I wish there wasn't this meta moment where it was like, oh, this is the part where I confess to you I'm in love with someone else, and then you scream at me, and then we're going to come back together. I wish she acted like, just like, what the fuck? Whatever. Like, just go.
Yeah.
And like, that would have been like the more emotionally interesting thing. And I think she could have won. She's a very, very great actress. Like, she could have won a 5-minute Oscar for doing something like that.
But I don't think it would have got the attention. I like, just because of not that she wouldn't have deserved it for an understated take on that, but it just probably wouldn't have. Yeah. And I guess
also Jane Alexander in All My President's Men.
In All the President's Men.
She plays Judy Hoback Miller.
Oh, she worked for Nixon.
No, she works. Yeah. I think she's the person who like gives them information.
She was a bookkeeper for the committee for the re-election of the president. So she was. I mean, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for the real person she was playing. I haven't seen.
That's
all the
one easy way to help is when we're talking about real people, like, real life performances, and you're like, oh, it's that person.
Yeah, and I will say, so like I said, haven't seen Taxi Driver yet. I would say looking forward to it. I don't know if that's the right emotion to have about seeing Taxi Driver soon, but
it's a great movie.
It's a great movie. I wouldn't say you should look forward to it.
Exactly. Jodie Foster's, it looks like, was like, what, like 13 in that movie.
She was great.
So that I doubt. Intense. Yeah, I'm genuinely surprised she got nominated, considering that role. Yeah. That's predict. I'm not surprised she didn't win, but I'm kind of impressed. She got nominated.
When you watch that movie, she is like, it's one of those like, this person's so undeniable.
Yeah.
That, like, I can't believe she didn't win almost.
Yeah. I mean, there's, we also have the, you know, wild benefit of hindsight that she did turn out to be Jodie Foster and
like
win
the greatest actress of her gen.
Get a ton of more nominations and Oscars and things like that. But yeah. And
she was born in 62, so she would have been 14 probably when filming.
Sorry, I'm looking at this. So Lee Grant was nominated for something called Voyage of the Damned.
Voyage of the Damned.
Which also stars...
Which is like an old school disaster
also
movie,
stars
right?
Faye Dunaway, Max Von...
Oh my god, this
Max
cast
Von
is insane.
Sydow, James Mason, Malcolm McDowell.
Oscar Werner.
Fucking Orson Welles.
Yeah.
This sounds... Oh my god. Actual events concerning the fate of the ocean liner St. Louis carrying Jewish refugees from Germany to Cuba in 1939. Ugh.
Ben Gazzara.
It seems interesting.
Sounds cool.
Oh my god, this sounds upsetting. It's about like the true story about how Jewish refugees were put on boats and no country would take them in.
Ooh, I'm gonna rephrase. Sounds cool.
I'm literally reading to see what will happen. What happened to them?
You don't want to get to the end of this Wikipedia page.
Peter Finch.
Oh, you're right.
Wins.
I did not want to get to the end of that Wikipedia page. I wish I had that. Oh, you guys keep talking. I forgot to plug in my power cord. Keep talking.
Peter Finch wins.
Which would make me mad as hell, personally.
Dies and then wins, so you can't be that mad about it.
This is okay. So this is something I wanted to bring up. Maybe I should wait until Jen is fully back. But like, this is probably one of the few posthumous awards that I think would have gotten the same recognition even if the person had died, because it just feels like this was like the performance of the year, and like everyone could quote, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore." I think Heath Ledger might have been nominated for The Dark Knight because it's a pretty fucking amazing performance, but I don't think he ever wins if he doesn't pass, because the Academies just hate that sort of movie in general. I was just about to say I don't think Chadwick Boseman wins, but like, whoops.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is probably one of the very few performances where I do think they end up winning whether they live or die. Or get nominated whether they'll ever die. I was looking at this earlier. Someone got, I can't remember who it was, gets nominated from Greystroke, Tarzan of the Apes movie from like the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Because they, like, who was that?
I have looked that up. Why? Maybe you and I were talking about it.
But, yeah, that's another one where it's like, I don't think that kind of performance in that kind of movie gets nominated from the Academy Awards unless that person passes, and then they're going to do a more of a tribute award than anything. I still think Chadwick would have gotten nominated.
It was Ralph Richardson got nominated. He's in, he was nominated for supporting actor for The Heiress. Didn't you just watch The Heiress?
He's so good in that movie.
Okay, and then he secondly got nominated for Greystroke, The Legend of Tarzan, presumably because he had just passed away.
Yeah. No, in The Heiress, he's so good in The Heiress. You guys gotta watch The Heiress. But yeah, I mean, he's in Chimes at Midnight, he's in Dr. Zhivago, he's in Time Bandits. Like, he's in a lot of classic movies, and, you know, then there's this movie.
That's funny.
He doesn't get nominated. No. Tarzan, Letter to the Apes.
See, the posthumous thing can be very motivational. Sorry, I'm still back looking at Network. Do we have any other Oscar-y thoughts on Network in particular? Not really.
What else was it nominated in? For below the line stuff, cinematography and film editing. That's it.
One script.
Not a set direction nominee. That's bad. That's bad.
I know, it is cool. It is a great art direction movie. Although so is All the President's Men.
Is that what won?
Oh, you know what's a cool nominee for art direction is Logan's Run.
Ooh. Yes.
That's a really cool nominee. Yeah, that's fun.
Yes.
What was the Logan's Run reference? There was a baseball one recently.
Oh, I said it to you, Jenna. Because it was about the Guardians released their like last player over 30 years old. So they're the
Brian Shaw, who like Guardians fans refer to as Uncle Brian. He's 34. Yeah. He's 4 years older than the second oldest player on the team.
The Logan's Runification of the Guardians continues. It was like the light in Brian Shaw's like, you know, wristwatch or whatever lit up and he knew it was his time.
It started glowing. Yeah.
Knew it was his time.
I just noticed.
Well, yeah. He got DFA'd and then the only other guys that we have that are 30 are Hedges, who they'll probably keep, and Luke Maley, our backup catcher, who I can't imagine they'll keep. Yeah. So we're going to be down to like one 30-year-old. Although I think Jose turns 30 this year.
Good Lord. As opposed to the Dodgers, I don't know how many players I have that are under 30. Not a lot. It's a little team.
But don't you guys have like one of the top five farm systems?
Yeah.
What are you guys doing for shortstop next year? Like, are they going to re-sign?
I think they want to keep Trey. Yeah. I mean,
they've been very happy with.
Yeah, I was going to say that seems to have worked out very nicely. So I'm assuming they're going to try to.
He's really good.
He is really good. And it's you know it was such
and
a
they've kind
oh,
of
Jose
fixed
just
his
turned
problems.
30.
Okay. It seems like it. No,
I do want to quickly.
Well, he's also like he's so fast. Like he will retain some sort of value. Like he doesn't have to be a 300. Mm-hmm. Like his bat doesn't have to be the bat of a 315 hitter because he can turn stuff into hits because he's so fucking fast.
Yeah, but yeah. Once the Dodgers let Seager go, I figured they were planning on trying to keep Trey.
I'm just surprised they haven't extended him already.
Yeah,
though. That's the like I assumed that they would have extended him like
at the beginning of
right after they traded for him.
I would have thought
or,
so.
Or like last offseason.
I don't know. So a little stressful that hasn't been resolved, but hopefully it's one of those just after the playoffs. Neither of us are worried about it, kind of thing.
Lux doesn't play short, right?
No,
or can he?
I don't
play
think
short?
So.
All
right, I do not think so.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm not. There's not really another plan.
Up and
there,
coming
no.
guy.
No, and I don't know.
And I don't see them signing Correa.
No, I genuinely don't. I genuinely don't see it happening. I mean, they can obviously be very mercenary about these things, but I don't see it happening.
I mean, I think the Yankees may just like say fuck it, like we'll do it and we'll make him our like fans will get over it when he's like being one of the best shortstop.
Yeah, I think anyone would. I think I it's probably disingenuous to be like Dodgers fans wouldn't get over it, but it would be tough. It would be tough.
Yeah, it wouldn't be very fun. And same with the Yankees.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. Yeah.
If he goes like 0-for-5 2 days in a row,
oh my god,
like, they're gonna.
Correa opted out. Is that what happened, or did he just have a short contract with?
He had an opt out, and I think. I don't know if he is officially opted out yet, but
he had was
out.
It him who had that quote that was like something about like
yes,
they
about
know
the,
what the price is. I go to the Dior store and they tell me how much whatever costs and I pay it and I pay for it and they know what the price is or something like that. Okay, buddy.
Yeah.
Also, what a relatable anecdote or analogy to talk about going to the designer store and you pay for whatever it costs. Oh Lord, God, we're
one more Oscar thing, but I did notice that Rocky got 2 supporting actor nominees.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah,
yeah,
Burgess and Bert.
Yep,
Polly and Mickey.
Yep, that is pretty funny.
Rocky was a thing, man.
Yeah, I'm realizing that I don't think I really realized that Polly and Mickey were 2 different characters, but.
I forget that too.
Yeah, they are. Mickey's the corner guy and
Polly's
the friend.
Yeah.
Huh.
Does he own the meat store?
Probably. I've never seen Rocky. I've seen like parts
of it.
I've seen like parts of it on TV.
I have, but it's been a long time and like it's
me too.
Whatever.
All right, well we've been going for an hour. What else do we want to say about network?
There's the scene where Robert Duvall talks about how good the ratings were going to be, and he's going to go talk to the CCA in the next meeting. And I think it's the sickest part of the movie. It's awesome.
I like every time that Robert Duvall shows up wearing his frilly shirted tuxedo getup.
Mm-hmm.
He's a real like Jack Donaghy type, who's like a network executive who just, it's after 6 p.m. so he's in a tuxedo kind of.
What am I, a farmer?
Yeah, it was genuinely the first thing I thought of, is I'm just like, so this is the life of a network exec. You just every evening, you got to put your tux on.
I love the woman who's pitching like just awful sounding shows to Faye Dunaway, and she keeps referring to the character. She's like describing the characters, and the characters are, she keeps on describing them as crusty but benign.
Yes. A crusty but benign retired Supreme Court justice. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's everything. Like, so Faye Dunaway, like we said, excellent in this movie. Speaking of things that are still, like, you know, obnoxiously relevant, like, she's the real toxic girl boss, you know, vibe that everyone mm-hmm. still complains about in mm-hmm. the year of our Lord 2022, where she's just girl bossing it up. And she's, I think, again, her, like, the tone of this movie. And it's kind of like she's the one, right, at the end, who's like, "Well, I know what we got to do. We can just have
we got to kill him,
and we'll just have the people do it."
Is it her or is it Duvall who brings it up? Because I know Duvall brings it up earlier.
I think she brings it up in
I'm
that.
Pretty sure she does
scene.
That. Meeting.
And then, but Robert Duvall is obviously immediately like, "Okay, yeah, so like, we're gonna do that.
Good, cool, we're gonna do
and
that."
And then there's the one guy, the one like sad guy who's like, we're talking about mm-hmm. a capital crime, but then the next sentiment is the network can't be implicated. Not like we shouldn't be doing it, mm-hmm. but like we can't be caught being involved in this.
Of course not.
Yeah, I mean, so just, you know, context I guess for that is, you know, so like you said, Beale's show it's a ratings powerhouse until it's not, because his
After he talks to Ned Beatty,
because his sermons, as they are, go from sort of being like angry, riling everybody up, to just being depressing about the failing state of the world. And turns out people don't want to hear mm-hmm. that so much. But because Ned Beatty has all this pull, they can't cancel or take him off the air. So obviously, gotta kill him. Only thing to do. Yeah, which, like you said, feels... it's kind of in line with the rest of the movie, but it just feels like a little bit sideways. Also, what do you think about at the actual end when we see the assassination take place? Like, nobody in the audience reacts. Like, did you notice that the guys get up?
Yeah, you would think that people would
jump up and scream and run out of the room. They all just kind of sit there while it's happening.
I'm like,
huh?
Huh?
Yeah, and I don't know if that's supposed to be a commentary or if it's supposed to be like they would assume it was part of the show, but for better or worse, I think maybe to the movie's credit, like, doesn't matter, we don't find out. That's the literal final thing that happens. Yeah. It literally cuts the credits.
I think it is supposed to be commentary. Yeah. Like, I think the movie's kind of meticulously crafted enough that it knows what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, these are all just, like, passive viewers.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen any Adam Curtis documentaries?
No, but
what are his docs? What are his docs?
Hypernormalization.
So he did one last year called "Can't Get You Out of My Head." That was like the 8-hour one on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So I watched Hypernormalization last Ooh. Week, and okay. this is just the like Wikipedia one sentence summary. It's it argues that governments, financiers, and technological utopians have, since the 1970s, given up on the complex real world and built a simpler fake world run by corporations and kept stable by politicians. And there's one point in the movie when he's talking about like echo chambers, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think specifically at this point, he's talking about it in relation to the Trump campaign mm-hmm. and how like Twitter and other social medias get to a point where you're not like you're filtering through so that you're only seeing things that you already agree
mm-hmm.
with.
Mm-hmm.
And really what they're doing is just making people more angry, because the quote that I wrote down is that somebody just summarized it as angry people click more.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what Faye Dunaway's character is getting at in this movie as well. Like, she wants a show to rile people up. But so I thought that was interesting that she's sort of like that part of the movie, and the movie itself is sort of arguing what I think Ned Beatty's character is arguing, is that it's not about like democracies and governments. It's just about like, it's money. Mm-hmm.
The dollar, the ruble,
the corporations,
Live in a college of corporations.
Is he very Daniel Plainview? I just realized I was getting into Daniel Plainview there instead of Ned Beatty.
Yeah. He's so big in that scene.
That scene
is fucking
also
great.
Wildly over the top. Like, you know, we were ragging on Beatrice Straight.
To me, unlike the Beatrice Straight thing, is the Beatrice, it's not nothing against Beatrice Straight. It's because that scene is supposed to be like the most human scene of two people that are falling apart together. Like, and so the fact that they ask her to go big is just like, this is not working. When Ned Beatty comes in, is like, I am God. I have destroyed the world.
They shoot him from below and make him look huge.
Well, what I like about it is we never are close to him. He is always in darkness with this tiny little light on him, but he has got the force of fucking nature behind him. And so that's okay. It's not like Ned Beatty's better or worse than Beatrice Straight is. It's just they give him a scene to actually be big in and not make it feel weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the reverse shots in that scene too, to Howard Beale, like, it's the only time we ever see him not like confident and brash. He looks fucking.
He does,
terrible.
Yeah.
He looks as if God or Satan is like commanding him to do something, and he looks just like horrified. And
yeah.
You don't think it's you think that it shouldn't work for someone to like bully him because he seems to be unbullyable because he's just like he's kind of lost it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the movie sort of implies that, and nobody really seems to care except for Max, but he's sort of like just. Like, he's having a mental breakdown. He's having, like, manic episodes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think that rationally, like, somebody telling him what to do is just going to drive him further. But he's just so, like, frightened of Ned Beatty that he goes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it gets him killed. Because it makes his ratings suck.
Yeah. which is interesting. Because watching that scene in the moment, you feel, I mean... Beatty is like a scary guy, but you kind of feel like he's right. And so it's interesting that ultimately ends up being the downfall, that mm-hmm. he's right, but that doesn't mean that that's what anybody wants to hear or that it's going to pay off.
I guess that's he's so specific in his prescience, unlike the movie where it's just like, oh, the people are bad and the entertainment and stuff. When he says like the world is run by AT&T, I'm like, oh boy, you have no fucking idea how much the world will be run by AT&T.
Just
like I was looking at their assets right now. They own Warner Brothers Film, Television, DirecTV, HBO, Adult Swim, Boomerang, Cartoon Network, CNN, TBS, TNT, True TV, TCM, and Viacom, and Paramount Global. Oh no, Paramount Global is the other half of Viacom.
Yeah.
Wow. If you click on anything on the TV, it's probably touched by AT&T, who owns your phone.
Yep, exactly. So,
and that's even more powerful than I think Ned Beatty's speech is. That's the one point of prescience that I'm like actually impressed with.
Yeah.
The other one stuff is like, I think I could make a movie about how evil the social media and like network culture is now, and it would be prescient 30 years from now because it's just always prescient. Like, so yeah, that's the one part that's like really like, oh shit.
Yeah. Yeah, that is what, yeah. I was going to say it's but that AT&T part, and there's other companies and things he runs like
IBM. ITT, AT&T, and I'm just like, But the AT&T one lives the most in my life because I probably consume AT&T products more than I do IBM or ATT.
Yeah. Well, what's funny too, so going to the Ebert essay, you know, so he wrote this essay, he describes it, he says like a quarter century later. So he wrote this around like, you know, 2000, 2001-ish time period.
It's been another quarter century since then.
Like, and he's already, and he talks about how a lot of it is like prophecy, you know, parts are dated, but that's really just more like the design. And his references here are Jerry Springer, Howard Stern, and WWF, like, or which now WWE. Ooh. Like, that's his references for, like, I don't know, bad things on television, which seem so quaint now. Like,
yeah, I was gonna
Jerry
say
Springer,
like,
and Howard Stern seem like the quaintest references for, oh no, bad things on television.
Yeah, I think we should give it more credit for being more prescient than it is, because I think we're seeing things from a much more extreme than it was even like halfway in between this movie coming out and now. Like, I think we're at a very extreme, like, politically, where shit has gone like fucking haywire. Whereas like 20 years ago, you wouldn't have believed, even 10 years ago, like, you wouldn't have believed that things had gotten like as
stratified.
I mean, timing wise, like, this was written before Fox News became what Fox News is. Like, it existed, but it wasn't what it is now. You know, it's pre-Obama, pre sort of the polarization. Like, it's...
Yeah, this is only like a couple years after Watergate, when like a dude was found to be like wildly corrupt and he just stepped down because...
Right, exactly, because he was caught. And so you had to, you had to resign.
And now, yeah,
that
you
really
look
changes
at it now, and it's
a
like,
few presidencies later with the Iran-Contra thing. I think the Iran-Contra
all
might be a turning point.
Yeah.
All Nixon had to do was like nothing. Just like ignored it, and 2 weeks later it would have gone away.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least now. Like, if that would have happened now, like, I mean...
Nothing, like...
Trump did way worse shit than that.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So, yeah. I think that's... Yeah, that is kind of the... funny is not the right word. But interesting thing about it is how, even from, like... It is so much more prescient now than it was from Ebert's perspective 25 years ago.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild.
Yeah.
And depressing.
Yep. In his, have you guys read his book, Making Movies?
No.
I read it over the summer, and it's really good. He like just breaks it down by like, this is like, I'm going to talk about the director for 15 pages, and I'm going to talk about acting for 20 pages. I'm going to talk about like editing and set design, and like just breaks it down into like all the different components of movie making. But he's in I think it's in the chapter where he's talking about just like general like planning for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about like, here are the themes of some of my movies, to like lay out what the theme is. And his description of Network is, Network, the machines are winning, or to borrow from the NRA, TV doesn't corrupt people, people corrupt people.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting.
He also, I wrote this down too. He's talking to Faye Dunaway. He says, or he's talking about Faye Dunaway. He says, I'd heard too that Faye Dunaway could be difficult. And then parenthetically says, this turned out to be totally untrue. She was a selfless, devoted, and wonderful actress. And he's talking to her about the character later. And he says, I said, I know the first thing you're going to ask me, where's her vulnerability? Don't ask it. She has none. Faye looks shocked. Furthermore, if you try to sneak it in, I'll just get rid of it in the cutting room, so it'll be wasted effort.
That's funny.
But I think that's not entirely true. Like, she does
in
that
the scene,
scene
with Max.
With
Max, she's,
when she says, don't leave me, she seems like that. Like, you see that she's actually like sort of a real person. She's
too much
of an exec to...
Right. That's kind of the only scene where the mask slips a little bit, I think, is it? And it's in the scene where he's calling her out, where he's like, you are going to ruin your own life doing what you're doing, living how you're living. Like, you're going to regret all of this. And, you know, you kind of, you see it, even though it then turns to her being like, well, let's have a guy killed. You know. Well, and I would say, the original... I mean, her original idea is crazy enough, which is like, let's have a terrorism TV show, and what we'll do is we'll tape them, we'll record them committing acts of terrorism, and then we'll do a little behind the scenes of how the act of terrorism came to be. And like, when you sort of put it in that context, it's like, I guess we really weren't that far off from like, okay, well, let's just have a guy killed, because we already are like sponsoring terrorists.
I'd watch that show, though. It does sound kind of like...
She has really good instincts for television programming, for sure. All right, what else? What other highlights have we not discussed? probably not enough nice things about William Holden. Like, he really does, I think. Like we said, he is definitely the emotional center of
William
this movie.
William Holden is, yeah.
Yeah. The speech that he gives to Diana is just so good.
It is. It really, really is. I think all of his scenes are really excellent.
Yeah.
Like, from the very beginning, firing Beale.
Don't
oh
do
God.
It, buddy.
Oh, God. Oh my God, that's... They allude to the George Washington Bridge story, and then when he's telling it to the room full of people and, like, just captivating mm-hmm. the whole room, and you're just like, oh, yeah, I know this guy. Like, I've met this guy who's just so, like, experienced and charismatic and, you know, kind of past his glory days and is always telling the same stories about his glory days. But he's also, he's as close as we get, I think, as to, like, a sympathetic character out of our main
yeah.
actors, and he's a incredibly flawed person, so
yeah.
One scene that is very funny is the U.S. Communist Party leader shouting about her distribution charges.
Oh my, I love that scene so much when they all are getting in fights about yeah the like distribution. Oh my God.
And then the ecumenical liberation army guy just like shoots his gun off. He goes, man, give me the fucking overhead
clause. Oh my God, that scene is so good.
It's so awesome.
Everything about the production of that, the ecumenical liberation army, the woman, that communist woman that they like bring in to organize all of it. Yeah. Oh my God, it's so funny.
The quote is, man, give her the fucking overhead clause. Let's get back to page 22, number 5, small a, subsidiary yes. rights. And then the next time we see, is that the same dude who, shoot,
yeah,
who
he's
shoots?
He's the leader.
Yeah,
he's the
yeah,
same guy. Next time we see him, he pulls out his gun and shoots.
The great Ahmed Khan.
Yep. Exactly.
Like, that's so fucking funny.
It really, yeah, you're talking about like, yeah, like the Canadian rights and, oh God.
Yeah. And then the last line is just should really end with like, this was the story of Howard Beale, the first known instance of a man who was killed because he had lousy ratings. It should really end with just like the sad trumpet, like
it pretty much is, yeah. That, the sad trumpet is implied at the end of that, and then let me ask you what you guys thought about the ending. So after that, I think it's after that, or it might be sort of like interspersed with that. The like it cuts back to like the four quadrant monitors, you know, and so
it's playing the
commercials
like it.
Over you do like it,
yeah,
and it's like playing like the Life cereal commercial and some other like brand, and then it like sort of fades out until it ends with just the image of dead Howard Beale for the entire duration of the credits running.
yeah,
I wasn't sure
talking
if it was
credits,
I wasn't sure if it was like a little
actually,
too much, but
yeah. It's network.
Yeah, and that's also when the title card comes up and it just says network. And then like, okay, yeah, I got you, movie. I got what you're doing.
Talking about credits, but it's weird that the opening credits are 4 minutes into the movie
mm-hmm.
in a movie from the 70s. Because it feels like a lot of movies in the 70s would just be like, start with opening credits.
Mm-hmm.
It yeah. starts with a voiceover. Then we have a whole scene. And then in the second scene, we start playing the opening credits, which felt... almost Drive My Car-esque, where it's like...
I was going to say, you know I'm a fan
yeah.
of that.
Yeah, but this is like a relative difference.
Yeah, it might as well, it's the modern equivalent of it being 40 minutes in, except for it's
exactly.
4 minutes in.
It kind of shocked
me. They should have dropped it like after the I'm Mad as Hell speech.
That's the midpoint of the movie.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, when I said, like I said, I thought that was the opening of the movie. So I kept waiting for it and waiting for it. And then when it finally
I remembered
happened, an
it
hour
much
in,
earlier than it did.
I'm pretty sure not the Sidney Lumet Long Day's Journey into Night, but the Be Gone
yes.
Long Day's Journey into Night. I'm pretty sure those credits drop like 65%.
Yes. I was going to say like 2 hours into a 3 hour movie on that one or something like that.
Yeah, I think it drops with 45 minutes left because the final scene is like one shot.
Yeah. That's one of those movies that I haven't seen because all of the things like, you have to see it in a theater. And then I missed it. And I was like, well, am I just never going to see it now? Maybe.
I would love to see that in the theater. I'll talk about one of the actresses when we get to what
ooh,
we've been
yeah.
watching.
We can,
the lead
we
from
can
that.
Get there shortly.
What is your guys' favorite Lumet movie?
Probably Dog Day.
Dog Day for me too.
Hold on, let me.
I have a lot of Lumet blind spots. I've only seen, like, I mean, I just recently watched Serpico and The Verdict for the first time.
I haven't seen either of those. Those two and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, I really need to see.
Yeah.
That's a good
I
movie,
I guess The
too.
Verdict for me is my favorite, because I've seen The Verdict, this, and 12 Angry Men. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And I love The Verdict.
Yeah, it's... So Long Day's Journey Into Night is 2 hours 18, and it drops with a full hour left.
So, yeah, okay.
Wow.
There you go.
Y'all need to see Murder on the Orient Express.
That's a Sidney Lumet movie? Oh, then I've seen that.
The one with Finney?
Yes, then I've seen that. Okay, yeah.
Great movie.
Also good. Sorry, now I'm...
So it's 57% of the way into the movie.
That's insane.
I don't think we've had a good late credits drop this year so far.
No.
It's early.
RRR.
Oh, I guess RRR is a little bit true. Later that than you think, like, it's going to be. Yeah.
Real late. That, I mean, the movie's 3 hours long, but it's still like 50 minutes.
I think it's 40 or 50
is
minutes.
Is it? Yeah. Is it really? Okay, yeah.
Well, because it does like...
Well, it's the end of Act 1.
You're right, because it does the little... Yeah, it kind of leads you in. That's true. All right.
Good show.
Okay, do we want to talk Ebert quotes?
Yeah, I got one.
All right, go for it.
The scenes involving Beale and the Revolutionary Liberation Army are cheerfully over the top. The scenes involving Diana and Max are quiet, tense, convincing drama. The action at the network executive level aims for behind-the-scenes realism. We may doubt that Howard Beale could get on the air, but we have no doubt that the ideas would be discussed as the movie suggests. And I think that gives a good point of, like, how all the different sort of tones and feelings it can go through, even though at times, like I said, I feel like it kind of becomes a little one note that should be commended from the movie.
Mm-hmm. I've got a short one. It's he says, one of Chayefsky's key insights is that the bosses don't much care what you say on TV as long as you don't threaten their profits. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one I was going to cite also. This is another one of Ebert essays where he's mostly just telling you what happens in the movie. More sort of like flowery, let me mostly just describing the things that happen in the movie.
But you see, if we put the money into the Arabs have to put it back.
Because the other thing, the other sort of comment, another short one, is just what is fascinating about, how smoothly it shifts its gears from satire to farce to social outrage. Which is really, kind of the key takeaway.
It's ebb and flow.
Watching this as Saudi Arabia becomes more and more in the mm-hmm. news, lately was kind of interesting. When they brought that up, I'm like, oh,
it is. Yeah, like I said, the sort of reference to, like, everyone's worrying about the Russians and then all the stuff about the Saudis, and you're just like, okay, yeah, really, really, a more things change, like, over 50 years change, is right. not really all that different fully 45 years later. All right, so where'd everyone land? Thumbs up. All right.
Yep.
Stars, Dylan?
Three and a half. Hey, another straight
nice.
Thing.
Yep. Yeah, it's like a strong 4 out of 5, from me, I think, on the 5 scale.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
A nice 3.5. So yeah, good movie. That was a fun one. And man, am I excited about Night of the Hunter is what we have coming up next. I'm super excited.
My all-time favorite movie.
You have said that about more than one movie that we've covered on this podcast, but...
What other one besides Apu trilogy? I think that's the only other one.
I feel like it comes up more often.
JFK.
Greed.
Broken Blossoms.
But I think Night of the Hunter has been in my top 10 all time.
Yeah.
La Dolce Vita wasn't when we went into it, but when we came out of it. That's another one.
What a good movie that is.
What a fucking good movie.
But and Night of the Hunter, I'm going to watch soon, even if we don't record super soon, because it's a spooky movie.
Nick, Janet, the opening scene of Night of the Hunter will happen and you're like, what the fuck is going on?
I've seen the picture Nick shared of was it Noah wrapped with the blanket around his head, and it looked like the floating head that you said was a Night of the Hunter reference.
Oh, yeah. That's like the very opening shot.
The opening shot is just fucking...
It's like disembodied head.
And my entire context for that is that picture you took of Noe with just like his head wrapped in a blanket.
It's Night of the Hunter is one of the most balls out weirdest movies I'll ever see.
I'm excited. I'm pretty sure I bought I have the Criterion disc that I bought at the last sale. Which, when is that sale coming up, by the way? We think this month.
I don't know.
It's usually mid-October.
Okay. Well, guess what?
Criterion does a 1-day, like a 24-hour flash sale. In October, and then Barnes does their sale, I think, in November. Okay. So it's like two kind of back to back.
This is very...
They should really spread them out.
This is very boring podcast talk, but at least it means I can use my Criterion money that I have on these October releases that I want.
I think I'm probably going to pick them up because I have a lot of like coupons from them that I haven't used. So I got a bunch of free.
A handful.
And then I want to pick up like the Safdies one that they released because I haven't seen that. I want to pick up Frownland. That sounds interesting. They've got a bunch of new releases that I'm interested in picking up.
But I want Lost Highway is out this month. So
I don't know if I'm gonna double dip or triple dip into the 4K of In the Mood for Love. I already have the Blu-ray
in the box.
Oh, Night of the Living Night of the Living Dead 4K.
Night of the Living Dead just came out.
I can't wait to get that.
And then next week is Lost Highway and Arsenic and Old Lace. The week after that is Cure. The week after that is Yves Bayou. Like, there's just a lot going on. So
drop that sale after Cure comes out. How about that?
Yeah, it's going to be close. Like, and that's the thing. And you can't do the pre-sales, so...
No.
Does Criterion not include
flash sale is in stock only.
No.
So it's no pre-sales and nothing they run out of. Barnes & Noble lets you do pre-orders.
That's the thing. I had them opposite.
No.
Criterion flash sale is no, because that has, that's why the timing, I'm like, as long as it's after Arsenic and Old Lace and Lost Highway, because I am picking those up. Yeah. Can't
wait. I'm just getting the Von Sternberg and Dietrich sale. That one's
fucking good.
That's the only thing I'm gonna get. I'm gonna walk out. That's probably the least I spent on a Criterion flash sale in a long time. Yeah. But I think it would be $50, and that seems like a fucking steal for those six movies because they are not anywhere. They are not anywhere you can find those movies.
Oh, they're not on Criterion Channel. I think they come and go.
They're very spotty. It's kind of like The Crowd, where it will come up and it's like 2 months and then it's gone again.
Yeah.
So, gotta pick this up.
They, like, saved all their box sets for the end of the year. Like, they didn't release any box sets, and they're doing three within, like, a 4-week period. Infernal Affairs.
The Hanukkah movies.
My Zetterling and Hanukkah,
Interesting. All right, well, anyway, diversion. Should we talk about what we've been watching lately?
Yeah.
All right, Nick, you go first.
Ah, shit. Let me pull up my letterbox.
I got mine up. Well,
I watched... Yeah, you go first, Dylan.
Okay.
It's going to take me a little while to...
Well, so I talked a lot about the movies I saw this week already, which was Sweet Home Alabama, You Got Mail. Both those really solid turn-of-the-century rom-coms that just died, and it's one of the saddest things ever. But I guess rom-coms did die... sometime in like the 60s and 70s anyway.
They're
like
cyclical.
Hopefully we'll cycle back around.
Yeah.
And they started to come around again as streaming things, but
not
it's just
same.
Really not the same.
I mean, I'm buying a ticket to go see Ticket to Paradise to see that Julia Roberts George Clooney.
I am buying a ticket, man.
I am voting with my dollars. I have no idea if that
would Billy Eichner call me homophobic for not going to Bros but going to Ticket to Paradise.
Probably. I wanted to see Bros in the time.
Billy Eichner's fine, but there's a difference between going to see Billy Eichner and going to see George Clooney.
That is the thing. I saw like somewhat like there was a discussion about like star driven movies, and someone's like, "Well, Bros didn't."
Which that's what they were back
right,
then.
Exactly, like, and it's like
You've Got Mail, Sweet Home Alabama.
So the sort of like on like the Who Weekly podcast, they talk about, you know, who's versus thems, et cetera. And like one of the ways you can differentiate like who's a them versus who's like a who, like a who's not a star, do your parents know who they are? Like, that's like a sort of good, my parents don't know who Billy Eichner is. Like, everyone our age does, but if you're not on the internet, do you know who Billy Eichner is? Probably not. No offense. I like most of what he does.
I just don't want to watch like 2 hours of like somebody yelling. Yeah.
I think he yells less in the movie. I think
he seems very understated for Billy Eichner.
I actually am worried it might be too much. Like, based on the trailers, I actually think he might be trying too hard to be understated to the point of flatness, but I'm going to watch it.
I haven't seen any trailers.
The trailers are pretty funny.
He's doing like his Bresson character. It's just Billy Eichner, stone faced.
A question that has a correct answer. Do you have a favorite Billy Eichner character or role?
Just on the streets? I don't know. Like,
the other Billy Eichner. Not his Parks and Rec one, I guess.
The librarian and Bob's Burgers is the correct answer.
Yeah, that's true. That's the one.
Isn't he a witch?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Or he just knows a lot. Is he a witch or he knows a lot?
I think he's a bit of a witch.
I think he is.
I gotta go back and rewatch Tina Witch. All of the Halloween, but that one's a really good one. She gets
Tina Witch is a great
cursed
episode.
By the crossing guard. Sorry. Anyway,
I also I showed Cassie a Deep Cover, which
it's on the channel didn't now.
Like a ton.
She didn't like a ton.
No, but to be fair, it's kind of like those things like Big Sleep, where it's like a noir without a lot of plot, and it's more of the vibes. If it's just you're not into that vibe, it's like you're gonna be like, "What the fuck's going on?" Like, they meet a new person, they kill them.
But it looks so good.
It really does. And Jeff Goldblum's the best.
That movie's great.
And then we watched Abel Ferrara's Zeros and Ones.
Is that good? I've heard that's good.
You know what? I don't think I can tell you if it was good or not.
Okay.
We watched it over the course of two nights. I was fairly distracted, and it is the weirdest movie I think I've ever seen. It is completely flabbergasting, but I got really emotionally moved by the end of it, and I think in the end I was like, that was pretty solid. I'd be interested in what you're watching. I loved it. And Cassie called it the worst movie she had ever seen.
Oh, that's the one that just came out. That's his new movie.
Yeah, it's wasn't Steven a big Zeros and Ones?
He gave it a 4.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't think I could call Steven a big unless he gives it a 5. He's pretty spotty with his 5s. And
I should check that.
Those are the ones that really matter.
The only Abel Ferrara movie I've seen is Ms. 45. And I watched that like 3 months ago.
The only one I had seen was King of New York.
Yeah, I haven't seen.
I'm trying to tell Kostya she needs to put together noir Lawrence Fishburne with Abel Ferrara's Zeros and Ones, and she didn't like both. Put them together for King of New York. The negative will become.
Maybe I'll try to watch The Addiction this month. That's been on my list for a long time. His Lily Taylor vampire movie.
Are you allowed to
only
add
seen
more
Bad
movies
Lieutenant,
to this
so
list?
The three of us are like just all over the place with our Abel Ferraras. Yeah.
Haven't seen Bad Lieutenant.
Let me just say, I don't think he's a director for me. Like,
that's fair. And then looking at his list of movies, I'm like, this just seems like a real test of which movie can be more unpleasant than the last.
You don't think you're a driller killer guy, Dylan?
No.
Steven does not give a lot of fives.
No, Steven's very careful with his fives.
Oh, I like throwing them out.
Yeah, me too.
I'm just like a little, like Johnny Appleseed with my 5 stars, just planting my little 5-star trees everywhere.
What is the most interesting Steven 5-star he has done? Doesn't he have Brooklyn out of 5 out of 5? Because if he does, what a fucking king.
Nella hates that movie. You know why, right? He's got Local Legends 5 out of 5.
Because
she
doesn't believe
choice.
That anyone would not choose Donal Gleason in a romantic triangle. Yeah, I mean, I get it. Yeah. But God, I love that movie.
He has Everything Everywhere All at Once at 5 out of 5.
Good movie.
Oh, yeah.
I also gave that 5 stars.
Oh, he's got Magic Spot as a 5 out of 5. You guys need to get on the Matt Farley train.
He's got I'm Thinking of Ending Things at a 5 out of 5. Which
hell
is,
yeah.
No.
I mean, that's not a 5-star for me, but I respect it.
Absolutely not.
I should rewatch that movie. That's like bad vibes the movie, but like I want to revisit that.
And then Randy doesn't have Brooklyn at 5 out of 5.
Logitech 5 out of 5. Let's fucking go. Do you guys cannot imagine how many times I said let's fucking go at the baseball game.
I can't
like,
imagine.
Every time there was a strike, I was just like, let's fucking like. Oh, he has hypernormal.
Oh, he does have Brooklyn. Yes. Best movie of all time.
All right, Dylan, anything else on your list?
And he has that.
I also, one thing I learned, not to go back to baseball, but I will. something I learned about myself is that when I'm stressed out and watch baseball games, apparently I say bro a lot.
You say bro?
like, bro, I can't believe they're not going to get out. They're not going to score, and it's been seven innings. Or like, bro, if this goes into extra innings, I'm going to like lose my mind. And like, bro, if this goes to the 11th, I'm going to die. And then three innings of just like...
just a lot of bro.
Bro, do we fucking die on the way up here? And this is hell.
Ironically, the movie next to Brooklyn on Stephen's 5 out of 5s is the short YouTube video called Too Many Cooks by Casper Kelly.
I watched a movie this week that reminded me of Too Many Cooks that I will talk about when we get there.
I have...
Wait,
what? For real. I will tell you about it when I...
I'm so curious about what.
So the last movie I watched this week, and it's really important. That's why I was kind of building up to it. But I watched the romantic comedy Morning Glory, which is about as opposite from Network as you could possibly get, because it's all about how we need to sensationalize the news more.
Or it's about how we need to desensationalize the news?
No, how we need to sensationalize. Oh, okay. The whole movie is like Harrison Ford is like this grumpy old newscaster.
An old funny daddy.
And he gets poured on like the morning show, and he needs to understand it's okay to be all sensational and make people happy when they watch the news, which is not the exact same thing that Network had in mind. And I probably like Morning Glory more than Network, so that says something about me.
Yeah, I skipped that one when it
came out. It's so good, Jana.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it's Rachel McAdams, right?
Rachel McAdams, okay. Diane Keaton, okay. Harrison Ford.
I am a Rachel McAdams like fanatic, so I'll get to it eventually. But
it's really good. It's very, very good. Why would you skip that one?
Because it just looked like a boring, glossy movie that I did not seem particularly interested in, but I'll check it out.
It was quite good. The final act is really a mess, but the first two I was like,
I thought you were going to say the final act is like really fantastic. Like, no, the final act, no good, but the rest of it.
There's parts of the final act that are good. It feels like one of those movies where you know how Nancy Meyers sort of works in like seven act structures uh-huh. without. This feels like a movie that was written to be like a seven act structure, and at the end of the second act of the seven, the studio was like, okay, you need to make this three acts, and then they cut the last five and put it into one.
Oh, gotcha.
So the parts are okay. The whole just was like, okay, what? That's by the guy that made Notting Hill. That's a classic.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Anyway, I loved it. So that's it for me.
Steven has Wayne's World as a 5 out of 5. Let's fucking go. God.
I have not seen Wayne's World since I was like 10 years old. I should revisit that.
We're not worthy.
It's one of the movies that I've watched the most in my life. Like a very comfort movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Nick, you want to go?
Oh, it's my turn. Let me make sure I still actually have my list up. Okay. I watched Confess Fletch, which is a nice little John Hamm. It's the perfect like high ceiling, low floor. Like I think everyone's pretty much just gonna give it a 3 or 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean high floor, low ceiling?
Did I say the opposite of that?
Yeah, you did.
Okay. Yeah, like, I don't think it's going to be anyone's favorite movie of the year. I can't imagine not liking it. Like, it's just a pleasant, fun romp. I watched Turning Red. That was pretty cool.
Oh, you just watched Turning Red?
I was really not looking forward to it on the basis of the trailer. Yeah. And I think the trailer, like,
The trailer does this movie real fucking dirty.
Yeah, real dirty. I watched a few Bergmans. So I watched Waiting Women.
Sorry, Nick, real quick, I had a question for you because this movie was up against a Bergman movie that year. It's Face to Face. What do you think of Face to Face? Because we recently finished the Bergman collection.
That is one of the few movies that is not in the Bergman collection. There's no Blu-ray release of Face to Face.
Okay, so you have not seen Face to Face.
Yeah, I think that is the most popular, at least on Letterboxd, of the Bergmans that is not in
I'm sure it is, collection. Is because it's fairly well known.
Yeah. But yeah, there's no Blu-ray release of it, so I haven't seen it. I'm curious about
it. Okay, my bad. Sorry about that.
So I watched Waiting Woman, which is pretty good. Brink of Life, which is pretty good, kind of a bummer. And
that's Kasia's all-time favorite, I think.
That's an interesting one to have be your favorite. It's pretty upsetting, even by Bergman's standards. In Autumn Sonata, which I wasn't as high on it as I thought it would be.
That's like an insane take. That's an insane
based
take.
On its reputation, he has much better. He has much better movies than Autumn Sonata.
I don't think he has any better than besides.
Yeah.
Besides Fanny.
I wrote about it in my review, but I think Liv Ullmann is going way too big in that movie, and I'm usually like a huge Liv fan, but she's just like gone way over the top. I rewatched Master and Commander. That movie rules.
That's the best movie ever made.
Yep. I watched a movie called Triad Underworld, which is like a triad crime film with Andy Lau. It was only okay.
Oh no.
Let's see. What else did I watch? Penda's Fen.
Which
is in that folk horror box set, and then a short that's on the same disc called The Pledge, which was not very... It's fine. It's just like your typical short that doesn't really have enough time to build up to anything good. We watched Barcelona, so we finished the Whit Stillman set out of order.
Had the order wrong?
Because I'm dumb. It was pretty good. I think it was my least favorite of the three.
Yeah, mine too, but it's still... good. And you get a lot of Chris Eigenman in that one. Maybe the most.
You do. Yeah. And he's really good. Watch Taipei Story, which Edward Yang just loves his like quiet dramas that build up to like moments of violence, which is pretty good. Watched Elephant, which is, have you guys heard of this?
Why did you watch Elephant?
Is that the Gus Van Sant
movie? Okay. Not the Gus Van Sant one.
Okay, because the Gus Van Sant movie is like one of the worst movies I will ever see in my life.
But this one, Gus Van Sant took his title from this one. It's like a 40-minute short of just like there's no plot. It's just people being murdered.
Oh, so it's that's why Elephant's called Elephant. Like the gotcha.
I'm good. Again, I think I'm good.
It's interesting. It's not like a great movie, but Danny Boyle produced it.
Interesting.
Oh, God, of course he did.
And then I watched Fall of the House of Usher, which is a Roger Corman directed Vincent Price movie. It was pretty fun. It's not like the best horror I've seen, but it was a good time. And then while I was out of town on my phone...
Oh, wait, did you see the Fall of the House of Usher or House of Usher?
It's called House of Usher on Letterboxd, but the actual title is Fall of the House of Usher.
Okay.
At least on the disc itself. So I watched these on my phone, so you like take that caveat for what you will. I watched A Few Good Men for the first time.
On your phone.
On my phone. Tom Cruise, pretty good in that.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson, okay. Pretty good in that.
Kevin Pollak, pretty good in it.
Jack Nicholson so much. Kevin Pollak's fun in that movie.
I wanted more Kevin Pollak, to be
honest. We could always do with more with Kevin Pollak.
Yeah, he's great in that.
Yeah, well, I think his character is by far the most interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
like
a great character.
He has to defend people who he doesn't like. And I think that goes way too unexplored.
I was going to say, a better movie, he would have been the main character, but then that movie like wouldn't probably have been made or as famous.
But he's not he's not as hot as Tom Cruise.
I mean,
no
offense, but yeah.
He is a hottie, though.
This was like a really good time for Tom Cruise, though. Like this was like peak Tom Cruise. Yeah.
Yeah, I watched another favorite of your guys' Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen before.
Dun, 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 dun.
That also would be a weird one to watch on your phone. Like all those like dark scenes, and you're just like they're like barely lit up in the submarine, and you're just like squinting at your phone.
It looks great.
Nick, where does this rank in the Tony Scott compendium for you?
Pretty high. I'm not a Tony Scott guy.
That's crazy.
Really. But this is one of his better movies that I've seen, I think.
Jenna, when are we going to finish our Tony Scott Denzel side pods? We have two more, I think, and they're my two favorites.
Unstoppable and Pelham. Are those the...
Oh, I completely forgot about Pelham.
What else haven't we done? Oh, Man on Fire.
Deja.
We'll revisit. I haven't seen Pelham.
We'll
I've seen
those.
The other ones, yeah.
I watched Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes, which sort of reminded me like of a maybe it's just because they were released by the same company, but it sort of had One Cut of the Dead vibes. Like, it's a short, short low budget sci-fi that I think was shot on a GoPro. Okay. And it's like 70 minutes, all one take.
Oh, nice.
Oh my God.
And it's about a TV that shows them 2 minutes into the future.
Oh.
And it's them like running up and down, like going, like communicating with themselves back and forth. And
where did you watch this?
I bought it on iTunes.
Okay, cool. That sounds good.
Yeah, I like One Cut of the Dead better, but it was interesting. Like, it's impressive that they were able to do this, like, in one take. And then I watched a pair of Johnny Toes. One is called Don't Go Breaking My Heart, which is a rom-com that's on Netflix. It was very cute. And then the other is a financial collapse-based musical called Office, which, among other people, starred Tang Wei, who is the lead in...
I love Tang Wei.
Long Day's Journey Into Night. What have you seen her in?
Sorry, that was just stupid.
You're like, that was a general sentiment of support.
Yeah.
She is, she's the lead in the new Park Chan-wook movie.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, which I'm...
So you've seen her at the top of the circle in Decision.
Yeah, I was going to say in that poster.
Exactly.
Man, that's coming out here next weekend. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I think it comes out
here. I think it's only 1 week and then it's out everywhere.
Decision to Leave might be like my favorite movie of the year. I'm just feeling it. I'm so ready for it. I've never been more ready for a movie.
One of the really funny times we had watching the trailer was like, they're playing the trailer and it's like detective, noirish, like murder mystery. And, you know, Matt's like next to me, like, we should see this. I'm like, oh yeah, we're going to see it. And then one of the like descriptions comes up on the trailer and it's like the most romantic movie of the year. And Matt goes, huh? Mm. And I'm like, I don't know. Let's find out. Like, because I think it's
I think it was... Fran Hopfner, who said there's very few movies that are described as Hitchcockian that could be actually Hitchcockian, and this is one of them.
I think it is. It's like a murder mystery, but then also I think maybe he like is falling in love with the widow, and was she involved?
Yes.
You know, very very Hitchcockian. Yeah.
And honestly, another movie that's like really fucked up but incredibly romantic would be The Handmaiden.
Sure.
And I think
also very Hitchcockian.
If you translated that movie as to Hitchcockian noir, that is me. That's all I want for movies.
I'm excited about Decision to Leave. I'm really hoping this month that like this movie year finally kicks into the next level for me. I'm holding
it. It was Katie Walsh who said it.
Oh, nice.
Katie Walsh. I knew it was a big blank check. Person.
Like a person you fall.
Is Katie Walsh?
No, you're thinking
Is
of Katie
Walsh
Rich.
Oh, fucking hell.
But, you know, there's a lot of, everyone my age is named Katie. It's fine.
Thank you.
Truly.
The thing I know Tang Wei from is Les Caution.
Oh, she's the girl from Les Caution?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Ang Lee.
Yep.
But no, Decision to Leave is
God. I'm excited.
Maybe my most anticipated thing.
I can't wait.
I fucking feel it. Let's go.
Back to my spreadsheet after we're done here to finish organizing what I'm gonna see and when. Oh, I can't wait.
All right. So, Katie, what have you watched?
It's my friend. My friend whose birthday is today is a Kate, not a Katie. But it's just your Kates, Katie's, Catherine's. They're just.
The hell happened there?
There's a lot.
I don't know. It's just. It was a real time, the 1980s. Okay. So,
Jenna,
Tang Wei
did
is
you
also
change
the,
your
the...
profile picture?
On Letterboxd? Yes, I did.
Me?
Did you?
That's going to
Sorry.
That's gonna
I'm no longer Margot Tenenbaum. I'm Laurie Strode. It is October after all. Okay.
All right.
So I'm going to go.
Tang Wei is also in Black Hat.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Just close.
All right. I'm going to go back. When on earth was the last time we talked?
A couple weeks ago, I think. 3 weeks ago. Maybe?
Okay. All right, I'm just going to go back, like, a little while. I'll just go back to The Empty Man. I watched The Empty Man. It was, like, 10 days ago. Mm. Freaky movie. Pretty scary and upsetting. It's very cold. Not, like, my typical kind of horror movie, because it's like, really cold and brutal, but very impressive. Did enjoy it. And then I watched a pair of movies via Fantastic Fest at Home. I had big plans to watch like a dozen movies via Fantastic Fest at home, and then life got in the way and I only got a chance to watch two. So not the most economical use of my home Fantastic Fest badge, but it was okay. Because one of those movies I watched was a documentary called Lynch Oz that's all about David Lynch and his sort of the role Wizard of Oz has played in shaping his filmic output. It rules. It's so good.
Sounds great.
Like, especially because, like, it's Karen Kusama talking about, and David Lowery, and, like, all these, like, filmmakers that I love talking about sort of their relationship with David Lynch and his relationship with The Wizard of Oz. It has a closing montage that, like, is just about the beauty of the movies and, like, made me cry. It's great. I'm really excited for you guys to see that. And then the second movie I watched that was also part of Fantastic Fest at Home was the one I sort of alluded to earlier. It's called Give Me Pity. And it is it's by this filmmaker I'm not familiar with, Amanda Kramer, who's made a couple of other tiny indies. And it stars a young woman my age, named Sophie Van Hasselberg, who I was like, wow, they really like, because it is a fake one-woman TV special. So it's like basically, and this woman, she looks exactly like Bette Midler. And it's like, what if like Bette Midler was having a, you know, one-woman TV special? Turns out this is Bette Midler's daughter. And that's how they found someone who looks so much like Bette Midler. Like, I literally Googled it because I'm like, this is unbelievable. Oh, genetics. They came for me again. But she plays a character named Sissy St. Clair, who's doing her one-woman show. And it's one of those variety specials where she sings a song, big musical number, and then there's like a little comedy sketch. But she keeps seeing visions of like a terrifying masked man on the sides of the stage. And then it gets more and more surreal, and her like sanity starts to break down. And that was the Too Many Cooks vibe. It doesn't get as surreal as Too Many Cooks, because what could? But it's a similar vibe where you're watching a straightforward television special, and then it just gets more deranged as it goes on. It was fun. So I have no idea when or if it's coming out. I noticed that it just had its West Coast premiere at Beyond Fest that's happening in LA right now, so it's making the festival circuit. I dug it. Very strange, 80-minute weirdo movie, but it was fun. Then I watched the new Dario Argento, Dark Glasses. That was Shudder did like on October 1st on their live streaming platform, a secret screening, and that's what it turned out to be. It was fun. Like, it was just a very like straightforward Argento, like woman getting stalked by a serial killer, except she's also blind and has like a little kid helping her. Ew.
Isn't that just Wait Until Dark?
It's yeah, but you know.
I guess there's no kid.
Also this movie is it's Argento, so it's a little more graphic, a little bloodier.
Yeah, sure.
Than you might expect. I was just watching something where a character was watching Wait Until Dark. I can't remember what that was. Then I watched Beetlejuice, which I had never seen from start to finish.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Whoa.
I was nice. Too scared of it I was too scared of it when I was a kid, and so I it looked too scary and I wouldn't watch it. And like, I've seen that I did know pretty much exactly what it was about. But Beetlejuice was great. Like, what a fun movie. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad to have seen it, and I'm sure I'll revisit it. Then
Michael Keaton should have won an Oscar.
Yeah,
for
he's
that
great.
Movie.
He's really, really good.
He's so good.
Then on Dylan's recommendation, I watched I Walked with a Zombie, the film by, how do you pronounce that director's name?
Jacques Tornier.
Good, creepy, like voodoo zombie movie. It is like Jane Eyre
mixed with Heart of Darkness.
Could have had a little bit more zombies, but as I was telling Dylan earlier, like the first half really sort of takes its time setting up this story, and then the back half is pretty intense. And I really enjoyed it also.
I just love Carrefour.
Yeah. Then I watched a Netflix movie from a couple of years ago called Apostle. starring my boy Dan Stevens, and it's directed by Gareth Evans, who's the guy that made The Raid and The Raid 2.
I did not know about that until earlier this
year. I did not know that until I was watching the movie, and I was like, who directed this anyway? And then I was like, The Raid guy, and then the back half of the movie kicks in, and like, blood and guts are flying everywhere, and I was like, oh, okay, The Raid guy, got it. But it starts, it's set in 1905, it's basically like, a colder version of the Wicker Man, like a guy, his sister has been either gone missing or kidnapped, and he goes to this incredibly remote island that's like has a pagan cult on it, and he's trying to rescue his sister. And so it starts kind of just moody and mysterious, and then it actually doesn't take as long as it typically does in these movies for everything to come out with what's happening. And once that does happen, then it's just a blood and guts and torture and violence and stuff. But it's good. I really enjoyed it. And it's very folk horror-y because it is very much like English pagan, like our crops are failing and, you know, how are we gonna... It's like The Wicker Man, basically. But I really enjoyed it. It barely exists because it was a direct-to-Netflix movie in 2018. And those freaking direct-to-Netflix movies, especially ones from that around then, like, they just get so buried. Fast. And like... The fact that I didn't see it till now, and I'm basically its target audience, is just a part of the problem. But I do recommend it, Apostle. It's great. And then this weekend I watched the new Marvel special, Werewolf by Night. That's their little one shot special presentation. That I guess is based on like a real comic and comic book character. Marvel has like a horror imprint, and so they're doing some of these special. Presentations that are kind of outside of continuity. This was great. It's directed by Michael Giacchino. It's his first like real directing effort.
Yeah, I thought that was weird.
It is weird. I think this is like what he wanted to do, and they were like, okay. But it's Gael Garcia Bernal and Harriet Sansom Harris and a couple of other character actors, or you know, people who haven't had big parts until now that I really like. Everyone is called to this mansion to like go on a monster hunt, but it turns out Gael Garcia Bernal is a monster himself. He is the titular Werewolf by Night, and it's shot in black and white, and it's like very impressionistic, and it's very much like a tribute to old, you know, classic Universal type or Hammer type horror. It's fun. It's 55 minutes, and it's very spooky. And if you like have an hour to kill and you want to watch something spooky on Disney Plus, I do actually recommend it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And
Guile would be so good at that too. He's another actor that should just be in it.
Yeah, he's so good. Perfect. He's so good at it.
He's never missed.
And then I watched Suspiria finally. After all this time speaking.
I did too.
Speaking of Argento. It's good. I wasn't as blown away as I had hoped to be by it, but man, it sure looks great.
That's exactly how I felt about Suspiria.
It looks great. It sounds great. I'm sure I'm going to like rewatch it a ton. I also just love Jessica Harper. Like, I think she's so fantastic and like could have and should have been a bigger star. She's in Bones and All. Oh, that's exciting. I'm looking forward to that.
Have you seen Shock Treatment?
I haven't seen Shock Treatment yet. I need to.
You should check that, because she's in that, and it's like, I'd only seen her in Suspiria, and way different.
Yeah, she's also in Phantom of the Paradise, which is what I love her from.
Oh my gosh, she's so good in that.
The insane thing, I won't say that I like the new Suspiria better. I do think the remake, the Guadagnino remake, is scarier, which is not, you know, necessarily a value add or not. But I like them both. Suspiria, man, that score though, I have the Suspiria score on vinyl also, and now I just want to listen to it nonstop. One of the best things about that movie is like things will get quiet for 1 second, and then the theme will just kick back in, and you're like, uh-oh, here we go. Good ending too, by the way. Suspiria has a very strong ending.
Yeah,
so
great ending.
That final sequence is pretty wild. Suspiria, great. And then last night watched Over the Garden Wall because it was time, so had to all of it. Yep. Well, watched the first half, stopped, watched a little bit of baseball, watched the second half.
I'm so glad you guys have gotten into that movie. Because both the times, the first times you guys watched it, you were like, that was good.
Well, we both of us watched it for the first time in the spring, which like should not be allowed. Yeah. Like, but we both watched it.
I was just reading Nick's review of it for the second time, and he was like, why the fuck did I watch this in spring?
Yeah.
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 Seriously.
So that's...
I love Over the Garden Wall.
It is great. And it gets better every time you watch it. Like, there's more little things I pick up every single time I watch it. Just a perfect little piece of entertainment. So, yeah, that was my watch list. And then hopefully, like I said, over the next few weeks, I'll have a lot more stuff I'm getting to. Because I haven't been to the theater since I saw Woman King. So I need to get back out. But it's getting to be that time of year. So,
yeah.
All right. Now it's been almost 2 hours, and we spent at least one of those hours sort of talking about Network. As we said, next movie is Night of the Hunter, but we're going to have a finale episode before then, because this is the last episode of our little mini season here. I don't think we came to a decision on what our movie is going to be for our Ebert hated.
Halloween 3, Underworld, and Prince of Darkness
were those were sort of the three. Yeah. So we'll decide. Watch something, because it'll be this month. And then we'll have the finale, and then we'll be back with Night of the Hunter. And I think that's it for this week. Yep. Thanks, as always, to our friend Scott Brady, and congratulations to him as well on the Guardians' continued success. You can find him and his Cleveland Guardians-related artwork at artbyscott92 with underscores between all those things on Instagram.
Perfect timing by him to drop
the SpongeBob.
He did SpongeBob art the morning that, is it Oscar Gonzalez? Is that the name? Hit the walk-off.
Mm-hmm. I regret, I was about to comment under it saying something along the lines of people might not know who he is now, but they will when he hits a home run today.
I mean, it's good that you didn't. You don't need to go jinxing that kind of thing. So if you'd done that, it wouldn't have happened. And so,
butterfly effect and whatnot. Maybe he would have done it in the fucking 10th inning.
Right. Who knows? but until our next episode, we will be watching a lot of playoff baseball, and people can find us at Great Movies Pod at Twitter and Letterboxd and places. And so until next time, Roger up.
Roger up.
Ta-da. All
right.
I need to get some.
I gotta hiding. Go. Just,
hold on, let's.
Just hiding from all the baseballs.
Go to the movies. I am that person on the screen. I am having vicariously an experience that happened to someone else. And that makes me a better person. That to see good films and to see important films is one of the most profoundly civilized experiences that we can have as people.
I've got like slow energy today. Well, I was like, I really just like was emotionally worn down by that.
Yeah, I'm surprised you have like a voice at all too.
I don't know.
There
were like dudes behind me who were like drunk and rowdy and stuff at the beginning of the game. They were cracking.
Were they drunk and sad by the end of it? Because that's like the risk you run.
No, at the end they're just like, man, like I can't keep doing this. Like the one guy's like, I'm sober now. Like
I mean, once you're
I'm
there,
not having fun.
That's the risk you
I'm
run.
Not having fun anymore.
You get drunk in the first inning. By the 15th, like you're like already hungover.
You've got your hangover.
Yeah, you like have a headache and have to go home. Oh Lord. Plus I know Scott like roasted me for this in the chat, but it really does just sort of take me by surprise when I'm like, people look cold. Is it cold there? And then
it was very cold.
It was 85 degrees in the valley yesterday where I was out to lunch with my parents. So I'm like,
it was like half that temperature.
I'm like dying through sweat. And then I like turned on the baseball game and I'm like, oh, they all look so cold. And then I realize it is October, which is,
it was like half that temperature. And it was also twice as long as more than twice as long as game one.
Lord.
Cause game one was
like 2 hour and 10 minute game. Yeah.
Yeah, there were two hits. There was like one pitching change. Shane Bieber works like super fast. And this was just, oh my God. It was It was excruciating.
Still very cool that you got to be there.
Oh, yeah. Like, one of the best, walk-off hits. Of maybe the best walk-off I've seen in person.
Oh, yeah. It would have to be, but...
Yeah.
Oh, imagine if it had gone the other way. Ugh.
Oh, I can't
well,
even...
That's how I feel every time, especially pre-2020, all of those, like... leading up to like 2015 through 2019, every time like the Dodgers were eliminated, I was just like, I don't want to hear the word baseball. I don't want to see a baseball. Yeah. Like basically until February. Like it's so like, yeah. I don't enjoy
us,
playoff baseball. It's not fun.
Yeah, like I was saying to Nelly, like this year I'm not going to get that worked up over the playoffs just because we weren't even supposed to be here. Like we're gonna get better. This was kind of like just proof of concept more than and that went out the window like right away.
Yeah, we're just happy to be here. It's not really gonna matter if we.
I'm not happy to be here. I'm gonna be so fucking mad if the Yankees beat us, which like
they
we
will.
Do not play well against the Yankees, like both in regular season or postseason historically. Like I'm not gonna be fun for the next.
It's also been funny to watch the Mariners fans who are going through the exact same thing, where it's like they kind of are like, "This is a miracle.
Now you gotta play the Astros.
We weren't supposed to be here." And then as soon as they're like, "This is awful. Why did I want this to happen?" Like, gonna be some rough series coming up. Fun. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well.
Fun game though.
So I like how I was like, "Let's start the podcast now. That's enough baseball." At least there's no games on while we're recording. We will be long done, so we won't get...
Oh, game three would have been starting in like an hour and a half.
But would we have just had to reschedule?
No, I would have watched it and just been like, it would have created a whole bad mood to our...
Cool.
All right, we ready?
Yes, now is the actual beginning.
Oscar Gonzalez.